You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is Brian McClanahan, your host, and this is episode 37, covering the week of August 8th through 12th, 2016. Glad to have you back on the program, and thanks for being with us. Thanks for supporting the program and supporting the Abbeville Institute. We'd hope that if you like this program, if you like the website, if you like our conferences and the things that we do, you would make a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. We exist on your generous contributions alone, so please consider doing that. All the details are available on our website. Also, like us on Facebook, Twitter, and do those things that share our stuff around the web. This is how we keep the mission of the Abbeville Institute alive, to explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. All right, so we had a really good week at the Abbeville Institute this week. By the time you're hearing this podcast, we might have already had our conference, which was August 13th on nullification. We will have that material available in video and audio form, as will our summer school lectures from June be available. It's going to take a little time to get those up, but they will be up. So if you couldn't make it, look for that stuff on the website or on our YouTube channel. Also, subscribe to us on our YouTube channel. We will have that material available for you. But hopefully you went, and hopefully you had a good time. So we had a really good week this week at the Abbeville Institute. A number of great articles. In fact, I think this is one of our meatiest weeks that we've had in a while. A lot of unique material. So on Monday, we started with a piece by Ryan Walters. Now, Ryan Walters, of course, did a wonderful job a couple of weeks back. I think it was July 12th, I'm sorry, with his Free State of Jones piece, which took down the movie Free State of Jones and showed how it was extremely inaccurate. And so he followed that up this week on August 8th with a piece entitled Debunking the Debunking, Gary Ross and His Myths of the Civil War. Now, to give you a background, what went on here, Gary Ross, who was the director of the Free State of Jones, put out a piece for the Huffington Post, I believe. It was a really short little video where he talked about four myths of the Civil War that he was going to debunk. And this thing has millions of views. And it's a short little video. If you want to get the standard narrative of the war, it's worth watching. I think it's about 4 minutes long. So I did a podcast on this on my Brian McClanahan show a few weeks back. But Ryan Walters took this issue to task in this new piece. And so I'll quickly go through the myths and what Ryan says about them. So myth number one was the Civil War was not about slavery. And this is what Ross is taking down. Ross says the Civil War was absolutely about slavery. And so Ross's evidence, as Walters says, was the same thing we've heard for decades. The state declarations like Mississippi say secession was all about slavery. And most notably, the election of Abraham Lincoln, who Ross calls an anti-slavery candidate, cited as the immediate reason the South left the Union. So therefore, Ross says it was all about the threat of the institution of slavery. Now, first thing you have to take apart is Lincoln being an anti-slavery candidate. He was none of that. I mean, Lincoln was not a candidate who favored the abolition of slavery in the South. He was against the extension of slavery into the Western territories, but he wasn't anti-slavery, and he made that very clear over and over again. So did the Republican Party, which should not include an anti-slavery plank in its platform. Ryan Walters gets into that. And to say that the war was all about slavery reduces the complexity of the event. And Ryan gets into that. He minimizes things like cultural differences, economic differences, which were longstanding. Certainly, I would say that you cannot discount the influence of slavery in secession, but the war and secession are two different things. Why Lincoln invaded the South and why the South seceded are drastically different issues. And so the war didn't have to happen. The Union, led by Abraham Lincoln, simply wanted to coerce the South to stay in the Union. That's what caused the war. And there's a really good article on this. Ludwell Johnson has done a very nice job talking about this in his book, North Against South. where he gets into how Lincoln essentially started the war. We often point to Fort Sumter and saying, no, the South fired first, or, you know, a lot of people do, not us, but not the Abbeville Institute. But a lot of Americans will say, no, the South started the war because they fired on Fort Sumter. But Johnson gets into how Lincoln really maneuvered the South into having to do that. And there's also another a wonderful little journal article about this, written in 1937 by Charles Ramsdell. It's entitled Lincoln and Fort Sumter, and it's published by the Southern Historical Association, the Journal of Southern History. He gets into how Lincoln was doing this purposely, maneuvering the South into having to fire on Fort Sumter, because if they didn't, the South would be in a position of weakness and illegitimacy. They had said that they were independent. It'd be no different, as Ramsdell points out, if the American colonies had allowed the British to maintain forts in various colonies during the war without having to try to get rid of them. So the United States had declared its independence. The states had declared their independence from Great Britain, all 13 of them individually, by the way. And the South was doing the exact same thing. So to say that the war was about slavery, you're conflating two issues. And certainly, slavery was important to the South, the Southern states. It was the basis of their economy. But to say the war was about slavery is incorrect. And Ryan does a good job with taking that apart. And he also points out that, you know, many Southerners, in fact, the vast majority, said they weren't fighting for slavery at all. They actually were fighting against slavery. And the historian James McPherson points this out in his book For Cause and Comrades. They were fighting against slavery, their own slavery. This is how they viewed it. That if they submitted to the North, they would become slaves of the North. And it's very hard to find in letters that Confederate soldiers wrote where you have an explicit declaration that they are fighting to perpetuate the institution of slavery. You find a lot of letters that don't say anything about it. They talk about independence. They talk about hearth and home. But expressly saying that they're fighting for slavery is very difficult to find, if not impossible. Now, myth number two. This is what Gary Ross takes down. The South was monolithic. So this gets into the central component of the Free State of Jones. And Ryan does a very good job, of course, in that particular piece on the Free State of Jones, taking apart that idea. And of course, you know, the South wasn't 100%. All Southerners were not 100% in favor of the war. We produced a piece on the website a while ago by Bradley T. Johnson that talks about how important Southerners really were to the Northern cause. You know, if you didn't have Southerners fighting for the North probably would have lost. So, of course, there were Southerners who sided with the Union. There was a long-standing Union here, and Southerners were, some Southerners were split in their allegiance. They could not fight against the Union. This is what they had sworn to uphold and defend, and they weren't going to support secession. So, obviously, there were Southerners who fought against the South and against secession. But the vast majority of Southerners, in fact, 75% of white Southerners served in the Confederate Army. And this is why when you look at Reconstruction plans and you get to the Wade-Davis bill during the war that Lincoln pocket vetoed, which required a 50% ironclad oath of allegiance in order for a Southern state to quote-unquote rejoin the Union, it was impossible because only maybe you could maybe get 10% of the Southern population. Lincoln recognized this with his 10% plan. Maybe 10% of the Southern population could be seen as never having supported the Confederacy. Maybe 10%. I mean, this is the ultimate. Lincoln himself recognized in his 10% plan that probably 90% of the South favored the Confederacy. This is often not brought up. You know, Ryan doesn't bring this up either. But 10% is all Lincoln required for a state to have a government, a loyal Union government, and be considered part of the Union, you know, resuming its status in the Union, out of rebellion, as Lincoln called it. So to say that you know, the South is 100% lockstep, no, but I think you could say it's at least 90%. And of course, you had pockets of resistance. You had it in Alabama. You had it in, to an extent. You had it in Mississippi to an extent. He brings up West Virginia and how this is the best example of how the Southern, how Southerners were against secession because they didn't support the secession of West Virginia. Well, that's because West Virginia was illegal. Even Lincoln himself recognized that. Lincoln said this, quote, and Ryan brings this up. Lincoln said, quote, "It is said that the admission of West Virginia is secession and tolerated only because it is our secession. Well, if we call it by that name, there is still a difference enough between secession against the Constitution and secession in favor of the Constitution." So, Lincoln saying, yeah, secession's okay as long as it's in favor of the Constitution. But it wasn't really in favor of the Constitution because the Constitution expressly states West Virginia could not do that because Virginia itself did not give West Virginia permission to break off of Virginia. If you are saying that Virginia is still in the Union, then you have to use the legally constituted authority in Virginia, and the West Virginia legislature was not the legally constituted authority in Virginia. So the whole issue of West Virginia is illegal. I mean, so Lincoln, again, is twisting the Constitution to serve his needs, and that's what Lincoln often did. And the next myth gets into that, too. Myth number three, emancipation meant immediate freedom for the slaves. Well, it didn't. And Ross points that out, but you know, Ryan says it's how Ross chooses to spin it that's the problem. Ryan says this, "Even though everyone knew that Lincoln's proclamation did practically nothing to free slaves, the South saw it as something else entirely. President Davis called the proclamation the most execrable measure recorded in the history of guilty man, because he believed Lincoln sought to incite a massive slave uprising in the South to, in essence, finish the job John Brown began in 1859. Davis lamented the likely result. If this occurred, the slaves, he said, are doomed to extermination because they are encouraged to a general assassination of their masters. Now, what's really interesting about this, if you look back at the American War for Independence, this was done then too. And the British actually said the American War for Independence was about slavery. Now, you're not going to get that narrative oftentimes. So I think some, you know, radical leftist historians have picked this up to show that the United States was always evil in their mind. That the British said openly, well, I mean, the southern states are breaking away from the empire, seceding from the empire, in essence, to preserve the institution of slavery. And, of course, at the time, there were also northern states that were slaveholding states, like New York. In fact, all the northern states essentially were slaveholding states. As they broke away, some of them started to eliminate the institution, but gradually, generally with compensated emancipation, and if it wasn't compensated, they would sell their slaves to the South, where it was really compensated by the South then. So, if we believe the British, then the American War for Independence was all about slavery. And that their proclamations against the war, one of which said that if a slave wants to, he can join the British Army, and they will give him his freedom. And so this was done exclusively to incite insurrection, slave insurrection, which Jefferson pointed out in the Declaration of Independence. That was seen as a heinous crime. And so Southerners looked at it in 1863 as the proclamation was issued, but there were also Northerners who saw it that way too. They also were against it, oftentimes, Northerners, because they thought of the problem that could come from this. As slavery ended, many Southern blacks would move north, and there were Northern exclusionary laws and all kinds of things that were out there, and Ryan gets into this, which were anti-black. So Eric Foner, in one of his moments of clarity, there aren't many, he points out that in his book, Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men, the Republican Party was the white man's party. That's how they sold it. And they ensured, they went to great lengths to ensure that that was known, because they didn't want to be considered to be a party that favored black Americans. In fact, they often painted the Democrats as a party of racial mixing. Because there were so many slaves in the South, they thought, well, here are these Democrats. They just wanted, there's so many mulattoes in the South. Well, the party of racial mixing. The Republican Party is the pure white man's party. And so they always tried to out-white man the next guy. I mean, this was well known in the 1850s. He also brings in what's really interesting is C. Van Woodward, who wrote a book entitled The Strange Career of Jim Crow, where he openly points out that segregation was actually started in the North. And this is what Woodward says. Northerners, quote, made sure in numerous ways that the Negro understood his place and that he was severely confined to it. Woodward also says that both political parties vied with each other in their devotion to white supremacy. It is clear, he said, that when its victory was complete and the time came, the North was not in the best possible position to instruct the South, either by precedent and example or by force of conviction, on the implementation of what eventually became one of the professed war aims of the Union cause, racial equality. So the North had really no leg to stand on here. It was hypocritical. The North had its own black codes. Of course, the North was denouncing Southern black codes while it had its own black codes. And so Ryan does a nice job of pointing that out. And then his myth number four is Reconstruction was somehow a failure or a noble failure. For Ross, Walter says, Reconstruction didn't fail, it was killed. And his most prominent reason was, quote, a counter-revolution on the part of white supremacist groups conducting a reign of terror and acts of terrorism which led to the advent of the Jim Crow era. And so Ryan says this, quote, the violence certainly played a role, but the fact is Reconstruction was not killed solely because of the actions of extra-legal paramilitary organizations such as the Ku Klux Klan. In truth, Northerners simply threw up their hands and walked away from it, turning their backs on the freedmen in the process. Why, he says, because the real Republican plan for the South had failed, and the Northern people had grown tired of the process. And so he points out that the radical Republican plan was generally anti-South, and what they wanted to do was remake the United States. Ryan says, quote, in other words, the radicals wanted to make the South like the North, sweeping away all vestiges of Southern culture and politics. Stevens stated, Thaddeus Stevens stated that Reconstruction was, quote, intended to revolutionize their principles and feelings, to work a radical reorganization of the Southern institutions, habits, and manners. But he says, clearly, this attitude did not pervade Congress. Ryan says, many conservatives certainly didn't toe that totalitarian line. Lincoln's naval secretary, Gideon Welles, called the radical plan an atrocious scheme of plunder and robbery, for it was radical Reconstruction governments in the South that stripped every last vestige of wealth from the region. Really, what happened is that the South got tired of this. The scholar William Gillette said that the North retreated from Reconstruction and abandoned the freedmen to their fate, thus showcasing further proof that Northerners did not have the best interests of blacks on their mind, only money, politics, and power. In fact, the very famous black politician Hiram Rhodes Revels said this. I mean, Revels was the first man elected to the U.S. Senate, first black man elected to the U.S. Senate. He was elected in Mississippi. And he later abandoned the Republican Party because the Republican Party has abandoned us. He recognized the Republican Party was using black Southerners as pawns in a game for political power, as Gillette said, money, politics, and power. And so he said, I'm for Republican ideas, but the Republican Party has left us. All they want to do is enrich themselves. And that's always been the policy of the Republican Party. This was a game of politics, and black Americans were pawns in a bigger quest for power. Okay. Speaking of the Republican Party, on Tuesday, we had a piece entitled Rats and Republicans by Paul Yarbrough. And it's a very short little piece, but he points out that Well, I'll just see. He points out that the Republican Party are what Patrick Henry called rats. And that the Republican Party really has never had the best interests of the South in mind, ever. He brings up the nomination for the National Endowment for the Humanities by Ronald Reagan for Emmy Bradford back in 1981. And of course, he later withdrew that nomination because people pointed out that Bradford had written disparaging comments about, gasp, Abraham Lincoln. You can't do that. That's sacrilege. You're attacking the American God, Abraham Lincoln. And so the Republican Party then left, which it never really had, and it's never really part of this idea of limited government and decentralization. You know, Barry Goldwater supported that, but of course the Republicans left Barry Goldwater flailing in the wind in 1964. And so Yarbrough concludes, quote, I don't know if the South will ever get its own limited local and independent government, but personally, I'm sure that it will not come through the Republican Party. The advice of those who are sure that the GOP is the answer reminds me of the thoughts of Patrick Henry, the great Virginia patriot who refused to attend the convention to alter the Articles of Confederation. I smell a rat. For a smell of rats, look again at some of the names above. And he points out all the establishment Republicans. People like the Romneys and the Rockefellers. The fact is, American conservatism has been highly influenced by the South, but the establishment Republicans don't want you to know that. Dr. Wilson and I tackle that issue in Forgotten Conservatives in American History. And perhaps at one point in the future, we'll do something with this in a conference to try to discuss how this would, you know, the Southern origins of American conservatism, the real origins of a real American conservatism, not the variety you get on Fox News and the mainstream, quote-unquote, conservative press. Speaking of real Southern conservatism, the piece on Wednesday by Clyde Wilson was titled A Southern Political Economy Versus American State Capitalism. And this is a wonderful piece. It was actually one of Dr. Wilson's presentations at the summer school, so we published one of those last week and then one again this week. And it gets into this this Jeffersonian political economy. What is that? What does it mean for America if we actually followed the Jeffersonian prescription for the American economy? And how that is opposed to the Hamiltonian system, which was foisted on the United States by the war, essentially. And because the South was out of the Union, they could not oppose any longer the Hamiltonian system. And once the North had codified this, put it into the American system, economic system, there was no getting rid of it. It became entrenched. And this is what we have today. And he brings up people like John Taylor of Caroline, who was perhaps, in terms of a pamphleteer, the greatest Southern political economist, because he pointed out what tariffs and state capitalism, which Dr. Wilson defines as state support of certain moneyed interests. He goes all the way back to the Constitution, explaining how when the Constitution was ratified. I mean, there is, in historiography, there is a debate. You know, Charles Beard came out and said, look, that he had an economic interpretation of the Constitution, which said that the Constitution was designed, now Beard was a progressive, but the Constitution was designed to support the money class. Now, Forrest MacDonald took him down and showed that that wasn't really the case all the time. But there's no doubt that after Alexander Hamilton became Secretary of the Treasury, when he offered or he desired that government bonds be paid back at face value in gold. Essentially, what he was doing there was ensuring that northern speculators essentially got back more than what they really put into the war effort. This was government debt. He's creating a debt. And Hamilton had said very clearly that, you know, a debt is not a bad thing if it's manageable, because a debt establishes credit. It also establishes patronage. It's one of the lost parts of the Hamiltonian system. he looked around and he saw all these former Revolutionary War soldiers. And he said, you know what? We can make these people loyal to the government if we just pay them. And essentially that's what he was doing with the debt holders as well, the bondholders. We'll just pay them. And they'll become loyal to the U.S. government. You buy loyalty. And to Hamilton, that corruption was what made the system, the British system, great. He just wanted to bring it here to America. And the other part that's often lost in this whole process is the Bank of the United States. People, of course, have focused on the constitutionality of the bank. But the really interesting part of the bank is that the delegation from Pennsylvania during the Philadelphia Convention in 1787 brought up a bank, and it was rejected, explicitly rejected, by the Philadelphia Convention. They said it outright. No. This Constitution doesn't allow a bank. And the reason the Pennsylvania delegation wanted this bank is because they had floated the idea in Pennsylvania, and they were defeated there by the Western Pennsylvanians. See, the whole battle over the Constitution in Pennsylvania came down to this issue in many ways, the centralization of monetary policy. And when the Pennsylvania delegation couldn't get their central bank in Pennsylvania, they got it in New York, then Philadelphia, and ultimately in Washington, D.C., much later on. Of course, the Bank of the United States was in Philadelphia. And when I say Washington, D.C., I'm talking about the Federal Reserve. Of course, that Philadelphia delegation was, or Pennsylvania delegation was long dead, but the idea continued out. And this is why we have a central bank today, which is unconstitutional according to the original Constitution. You can't have it. But that would be a whole other piece about the constitutionality of the American banking system, or at least the central banking system. And so this is a great piece. It talks about, you know, how Taylor called men of finance paper jobbers because they didn't produce anything, and how Calhoun had prophetically stated that the real dispute in America was between the tax producers and the tax consumers. You were enriching some at the expense of others. This is the real Southern critique of American state capitalism. You're making certain people rich at the expense of the American people, or the people of the states. There is no aggregate American people, but the people of the states are enriching some through tariffs and government handouts and subsidies. The fusion of banking and organized finance with government. In fact, Clyde provides a wonderful quote from a Southern newspaper in 1843 that said the Southern position was simply free trade, no debt, and separation of the government and banks. This was 1843. There's deeper issues here. We talked about the myth-making of Gary Ross. There's deeper issues at stake than just slavery. It's very clear if you look at the Jeffersonians, their major problem with the general government was unconstitutional power being exercised to enrich some at the expense of others. It was that Hamiltonian political economic system. And wherever it reared its ugly head, the South was opposed to it. And that's because the South was being plundered by the North. And I know there's people who go, oh, no. The North was paying just as much in tariffs, or they're paying more in tariffs in the South. This is all hogwash. Arr. It's quite clear it wasn't. And that Southerners were building up Northern manufacturing through high tariffs, taxes, essentially. Now, there were certain Southern planters who didn't mind because they made a lot of money on Northern factories. They didn't care where they sold their cotton. They're going to make money anyways, whether they sell it to England or New England. But the vast majority of Southerners were being plundered by these policies, these tax policies to enrich a few at the expense of the many. And that was the real problem. That's what John Taylor saw as the real problem with the American state capitalist system. The state props up the big bankers of the North. And Clyde also points out, you know, after the war was over, greenbacks, which had become basically worthless during the war, were redeemed at face value in gold, thus taxing the South. The South was paying reparations by doing this. The South had lost all its capital, but they were paying back Northerners in gold and by redeeming their greenbacks. Greenbacks the South did not have. So the North made a lot of money on the war. Thad Stevens, the quote-unquote great commoner, made a lot of money on the war through iron contracts. A lot of Northerners did things like that. And of course, the entire Gilded Age, as the economic reconstruction continued. I mean, this is often not pointed out, but the Gilded Age, the quote-unquote Gilded Age, that, well, it's the robber barons and all these people going out and making a lot of money, free market run wild. It really wasn't. The Gilded Age was propped up by the general government. And most of the money that was made in the Gilded Age was made in railroads, which were a bastion of corruption and graft. I mean, it was a period of tremendous government expenditures, making certain people very wealthy. And of course, the thing that the railroad industry did was made other people wealthy. It wasn't just the railroads themselves. You had to have the iron or the steel. You had to have things. You had to have timber. You had to have oil. You had to have things that made the railroads work. But railroads were the continuation of this Hamiltonian economic corruption out west through government subsidies and the fact that they would give the railroads the best land on either side of the track, and then they could sell that land to make money on it. So, I mean, that whole entire economic reconstruction, and people don't often see it that way, but the Gilded Age was economic reconstruction. It's just simply continuing the process. It's just not called that. And when you look at the early 20th century, the piece that we produced on Thursday was entitled The Vanishing Republic of Our Fathers, written by yours truly, and actually took that line from Oscar Underwood, who penned an op-ed in 1927 entitled the same thing. And so I talk about that op-ed, but the interesting thing about this piece, again, this is 1927. This New South period is often overlooked. All we ever talk about is the racial strife of the New South. We don't talk about what Southerners were actually saying about other things as well. And Underwood from Alabama was, and when he wrote this piece in 1927, and then his autobiography, sort of autobiography, in 1928, he brings up the Jeffersonian political economy again. He says, look, the South is still under the yoke of the federal government. And all of these things that they're doing, all these boards and commissions and the Federal Reserve itself, all of these things are enlarging the power of the executive branch unconstitutionally at the expense of the American people. And we should stop this. And I'm going to read to you his conclusion because it's so good that it's worth reading. And I quoted it in its entirety. And he titled this section of the op-ed, Nationwide Scope. And this is a quote. This everything I'm going to read to you now is Oscar Underwood speaking in 1927. It may be said that we cannot regulate the business affairs of the nation except by federal control, that the regulation must be uniform and nationwide. I do not concur in this sentiment. Now, let me stop here for a second. When he's saying regulation of business, he's talking about the Hamiltonian system. Regulation was just a code word for massive federal involvement in the economy, which had been going on since Reconstruction. Back to Underwood. There are good local laws in Maine that require the householder to clean the snow off his front sidewalk in the winter months. Such a law would be both foolish and oppressive in Alabama, where the sun always cleans the snow from the sidewalk a few hours after it falls. So it is with business. What may be sensible regulation in one state may be unnecessary or oppressive in another. With regard to local self-government, we cannot repeat too often what Thomas Jefferson so well said in the young days of the Republic, quote, our country is too large to have all its affairs directed by a single government. Public servants at such a distance and from under the eye of their constituents must, from the circumstances of distance, be unable to administer and overlook all the details necessary for the good government of the citizens in the same circumstances by rendering detection impossible to their constituents will invite the public servants to corruption, plunder, and waste. What an augmentation of the field for jobbing, speculating, plundering, office building, and office hunting would be produced by an assumption of all the state parent into the hands of the general government. Those words are prophetic, Oscar Underwood says. They are as true today as they were the day they were first uttered more than 100 years ago. Many important events have come and gone in the kaleidoscope of time within the last three decades. Victories in war and peace, great advancements in science, learning, and art. But I doubt whether there has been any happening in the era beginning with the advent of the material control and centralization of power. Just as the war with Spain was begun, and which seems to still be with us, that so adversely affected the lives, happiness, and liberties of the American people, as the surrender by the Congress of a government of law and the inauguration of a bureaucratic government in its place. From here, where do we go? No man can predict. Has the era spent its force, and will the pendulum swing back? Or shall we go until we have a republic only in name that promulgates its rules and regulations to please the fancy and desire of the chosen few who are to constitute the governing class for the future? And so he said that in 1927. Where are we going to go from here? Will the pendulum swing back? But it hasn't. It's never swung back, as I said. This Hamiltonian system has now completely engulfed what Clive was calling, you know, a Southern political economy. You know, Underwood was famous for the Underwood tariff reduction when Woodrow Wilson was president. It's also during that tariff that you got a very high income tax. And in my book, Nine Presidents Who Screwed Up America, I point out that Southerners were in favor of many of these things because they were simply using the government apparatus that they were given to undermine the Northern state capitalist system. They were going to use the mechanism that the North created to get back at the North. And so you have these Southerners, there's many of them, saying things like this, but all we ever focus on is race. And that shows where the vast majority of the historical profession is. They don't actually do real scholarship. They don't point these things out. They don't get involved in these things and really bring out this stuff. The New South is a wide open field. If any of you who are listening to this podcast are interested in pursuing graduate studies in history, or I would say go after that New South period. It's a virgin territory for real scholarship. And there are so many ways you can take this thing down, take apart the modern narrative of it. It's so easy. It's ripe for the pickings. So Underwood's saying in 1927, where do we go from here? Well, obviously, I don't know. Where do we go from here in 2016? We're dealing with the same issues. We have the massive bureaucratic state. We have the executive branch that has consumed all other branches of government. And really, there are four branches of government, as we pointed out in our conference on nullification. There are four branches of government. There's the three branches at the federal level, and then there are the states. The fourth pillar, you can have a three-legged stool, but a four-legged stool is much more stable. And so the U.S. government was designed with four legs in mind. In fact, one of the legs, the states, were the most stout. And that's, we don't even talk about that anymore. Underwood's talking about it. But no one in America talks about it anymore. Well, some do, but very few, particularly not in the political class. And finally, on Friday, we had a piece by Dave Benner, Jefferson's True Wall of Separation. This gets into the idea, you know, Jefferson had written a letter to the Danbury Baptists saying that there's a wall of separation or separation of church and state, which is nowhere, that phrase is nowhere in the Constitution. In fact, Jefferson was very much in favor of trying to eliminate state support for churches, but he wasn't in favor of eliminating religion from public life. And Dave does a very nice job of pointing this out. He sympathized with the Danbury Baptists because they were being persecuted by the state-established church in Massachusetts. Jefferson himself had tried to root out any type of state funding for an established church in Virginia. But that's a different case than the First Amendment. The First Amendment said, essentially, that there would be no federal support for a state-established church. Establishment of religion meant there would be no church of the United States, but it did not mean that religion would be devoid from public life. I mean, it's very easy to see that they meant this because you had, as Benner points out, You had official chaplains of the U.S. Congress. You had prayers in Congress. The Congress itself, the Capitol building itself, was actually used as a church at times. So to say that the founding generation didn't want religion in public life is just completely preposterous. But you still had state-established churches after the Bill of Rights was ratified. In fact, in three states you had it. It wasn't until much later that these state-sponsored churches were disestablished. Now, in Virginia, it was disestablished. But you had them in New England states. And so while Jefferson may sympathize with the persecution of peoples in Massachusetts by a state-established church, he would not advocate using federal power or the court system, which Hugo Black did, through the faulty doctrine of incorporation, which is a whole other issue, to eliminate any pronouncements of religion in public life. I mean, this is where we've gotten. If you just simply say a prayer before some government services in certain states, you're going to be sued. This is where you have these crazy people going out saying, you know, if you're a business and you allow churchgoers to have a 10% discount if they bring a church bulletin, that's a violation of freedom of religion. This is how stupid these things are. Really, I mean, there's no other word to describe it but stupid. Backwards, upside down, distortion of what Jefferson meant and what the First Amendment means. So, you know, we have these issues, and they're completely contrary to the meaning Jefferson ascribed to them, and same thing with the founding generation, the First Amendment. Clearly, the First Amendment was applied only to the general government, not to the state governments. This idea of incorporation was actually rejected during the first Congress when Madison wanted to include an incorporation amendment, which was, I mean, outright rejected. And the idea that the 14th Amendment somehow incorporates the Bill of Rights, again, is a twisting of the meaning of the 14th Amendment. But that's a whole other issue. And, you know, Hugo Black, who I mentioned in the piece on Thursday, who actually ran against Oscar Underwood and beat him in 1926. The reason being, Oscar Underwood was against the Klan, and Black was a Klan member. And so Underwood had no support from the Klan in the state of Alabama. He wanted to get the Klan out of politics. And Hugo Black had all their support. And so then Hugo Black later becomes this progressive Supreme Court justice who does great damage to the original Constitution through the faulty doctrine of incorporation. But that, again, is a story for another time. So I hope you enjoyed this this podcast. Please consider donating to the Abbeville Institute. Again, we exist on your generous contributions alone. We have other programs coming up. I don't think, I'd mentioned in another podcast we're going to do something in the fall that's been postponed for a number of reasons. So I don't think we're going to have another conference in 2016. Not one that's scheduled right now anyway. So it's probably going to be early 2017 that we have our next conference. Don't know where it's going to be yet and don't know on what topic, but it'll be there. And we look forward to a great 2017. But your contributions will help us do things like this. Keep this podcast going. Keep the website going. And help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Until next time, good day.